In the bonus room, Madeline talks about Baroque performance ideas and incorporating them into the modern symphony orchestra. We end our conversation by discussing several of her other projects, the Haitian Orchestral Institute, and how she has rescued over 100 kittens.
I feel like one thing in the string section, because even if I'm the concertmaster, I'm playing as part of a section most of the time.
Right.
And that makes it a little easier to not become paranoid. I feel like woodwinds, man, they're always playing their own part. They're always on, you know, and then they're spending all their time making reeds and doing things like that. I mean, that's a tough gig for sure.
Making reeds.
Or the horn or the trumpet. I mean, the potential for humiliation is higher, I think.
Been there, done that. Yeah.
Cracking or whatever it is. And so I think that probably wears on people over time. But for example, I mean, I think there can't be any cliches because our principal trumpet, Travers Peterson, is the nicest guy in the world.
Yeah.
Not to say that other trumpet players aren't, for mm-hmm. all of you listening, but, you know, I mean, he's just so sweet and kind of mild-mannered, which hasn't generally been my experience with trumpet players.
Really? Okay.
Usually, you know, alphas, you know, they're really, it's not, and he's such a beautiful player, but it's just, I definitely would want to try to pigeonhole, you know, any instrument because it comes in all types of people. So.
Okay. Well, you've guest concertmaster with a number of different orchestras. I think Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, most recently you play at the Grand Teton, of course, Utah Symphony and a few others. Do you notice differences between these orchestras in terms of interpretation, sound production? Some orchestras are more aggressive, others may be more tend towards dolce playing or whatever. I mean, when you sit in a concertmaster chair of an orchestra for the first rehearsal, do you immediately pick up that how an orchestra is like a little bit different from an orchestra you're used to playing with?
Yeah, that's a really good question. When I first started doing more guest playing, I think I took a lot on myself, you know, as far as like, oh, this part doesn't sound good because I must not be leading correctly or it must be somehow my fault. Like, surely normally this always sounds good. But then you learn the more you do it that we're all just humans, you know. So
yeah.
It's like just because it's a crazy huge orchestra with a major reputation doesn't mean that really there's much I can do in 1 week to change anything. Do you know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah, sure.
So part of me, it's kind of a tough challenge because you're going into it having to lead without really knowing what you're going to get. And then also, you know, trying to improve what you feel might get better over the course of the week and also respecting the orchestra's individual style and things like that. So the more I've done it, the more I enjoy it though, because I can kind of tell, okay, this is something that this orchestra just does and that's not going to change. Or this is something that maybe I could help improve over the week, you know, or sometimes you're just along for the ride, you know. So it's a very different experience depending on where you are. I also have tended to be guesting when it was a guest conductor, which is a very, very different vibe from a music director.
Oh.
And both times I was in Pittsburgh was with a conductor that had never been there before. So that makes it a little easier because they're also not familiar with the conductor, you know. So it's sort of everybody's starting from square one a little bit. I think going into a situation, if you were working with a music director who the orchestra knew very, very well, that would be much, much more difficult. Then you're really trying to fit in with, even though you're leading, you're also just trying to fit in with
right.
what's happening. And I think that's much more difficult than sensitive. With a guest conductor, especially a new one, it's a little bit of a free-for-all as far as. Interestingly, when I was in Pittsburgh for the first time, I played the same piece that I played in Houston in the same season, Elgar's First Symphony, which
well,
was
I've never
really
heard that.
Interesting. Okay, yeah, so it's not often played. We had happened to play it in Utah just the year before, so I really was familiar with it. And I got to have the experience of playing it with Pittsburgh in March of 2018 with a new-to-them guest conductor, and then playing it in the fall of 2018 in Houston with also a new to them guest conductor. So that was really cool. Cause I mean, how are you going to ever get apples to apples like that to understand, you know, how the orchestra reacts to a piece that neither orchestra had played since the '80s, I think. So, and to a guest conductor that was new to them. And so that was really fascinating. I thought it was, you never get a chance to compare something so directly like that.
And were the orchestras really different in their sort of feel or interpretation about the piece?
I wouldn't say terribly. I mean, in Pittsburgh, it was Sir Mark Elder was the conductor. Of course, he has so much of a, mastery over Elgar and the other repertoire from his homeland. So, no, I mean, in the end, both orchestras sounded great. It was just a matter of how the orchestra adjusted to a piece they hadn't played in a really long time and a conductor they didn't know and how the week went. It was a really interesting experience.
So if you're, let's say, if you're playing with whatever orchestra, and you're playing, let's say, La Mer of Debussy one week, and you're playing, let's say, Brahms the next week, is it a conscious decision how you're going to use your vibrato, or is it? I'm sort of going into the weeds here, but is that something you think about, or is it something that over time you just sort of know what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't on an individual level think about it that much. It kind of just happens. But if you're leading, major orchestras know how to play Debussy versus Brahms, so you shouldn't have to address anything verbally. You just do it and they go along and probably have the same opinion about their Debussy vibrato that I would have. So yeah, it's not something I think about or especially wouldn't necessarily dictate unless it seemed like there was a problem. Sometimes, with whenever you have a group of 30 or 32 violins, there may be players that don't like to play in such and such style. And as a guest, it's pretty hard to, if it's your own orchestra, you address those issues and get them on board with the plan. But as a guest, there's a limit to what you would want to put your foot in it.
It seems like it
You know what
seems
I mean?
yeah, sure. It seems like orchestras these days are a lot more flexible than orchestras of, let's say, 30 years ago. I mean, thinking of, certain German orchestras would play Debussy and they'd call it Das Meer. And now I think, you have somebody like Simon Rattle coming to Berlin Philharmonic, and I think that changed the orchestra quite a bit, made them a lot more flexible.
An expectation now that orchestras are flexible in style. That's why it's weird every once in a while you get someone, like I said, who wants to play Bach with it long and vibrated and it's hard to do it because we're so well trained now in our historical informed style, so.
So just following up on that a little bit, do you with a violin section for a modern orchestra, how many people do you think, what percentage of people would be familiar with Baroque phrasing? I was going to say articulation
Oh,
because I'm a trumpet
well,
player.
yeah. Nowadays,
Really?
most people, I think, if they, the younger the player, the more likely, they were at New World and somebody came in and helped them all learn how to do it, even if, or if their school, they went to Indiana University and they played in the Baroque Orchestra or some such. The younger players, many of them have had actual classes on it or played with quite prominent people at some point or a music festival, for us older players, which I'll now lump myself into. If I mean, I had a specialized upbringing, but most of the people, say 50s and older, probably didn't have that opportunity to play on Baroque instruments when they were young, But we've learned how to do it, having specialists come and learning. I mean, I would surprise to find very many high level orchestral players in the United States who didn't know how to do it. Whether they
Wow.
like it or not, that's another question. Whether they think it's right or whether they think it's effective or whether they'd rather play it the other way, very likely. Some people, sure, but I think most people can do it now. They know how to taper, they know how to retake. I think you'd be surprised. I think it's become, and even in the last 10 years, kind of just expected. I had a guest conductor come through a few years ago who called me and was a Baroque specialist and kind of early in his career, so he didn't really know what to expect from a normal orchestra. You know what I mean? As far as like, he called me and he's like, "So is this if I s like th if I said this in rehearsal, would they know?" And I was like, "Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we all know. And the bowings are all retakes and double dots. We've got you. We covered."
When
So.
you say retakes, you mean what?
So again, wish you could see me for this 1 second only. But so, like opening of the Messiah, everybody knows that. Da, da 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 da. So each note you play down bow, then you take the bow off the string and go back to the frog and play a small up bow.
And that's called a retake.
it's a retake, so you're not like playing an up bow without moving your bow. You move it in the air and then you play the bow, very small up bow. But 40 years ago, I guarantee they were going down, down, up, up, down, and probably
Right,
less than
right,
40
right,
years
right,
ago,
right.
right?
Yes,
So
yes.
now I would be shocked to have someone come and want to do the Messiah like that. 20 years ago, it was a mixed bag, I'd say,
Yeah.
but these days it's pretty standard to incorporate some of those kind of historically informed trends.
It seems to me like the brass, there are not as many brass players then who are up on that as
Oh,
string
really?
players. Well, I live in Germany now, so I'm way out of the loop in terms of the United States. But I mean, I think in a lot of orchestras, I mean, one thing, I mean, the Baroque trumpet is probably more different from the modern trumpet than the Baroque violin is from the modern violin. I think I could be
Yeah,
wrong
it's
on
a
that.
beast of an instrument. I mean, I can't even imagine
Yeah,
trying
it
to
is.
play the trumpet. It's a
Yeah,
nightmare.
yeah.
Yeah, our instruments are different, but not so. I mean,
Nice thing, I think, for trumpet, for
yeah.
example, and maybe not quite as much so for horn. But do you ever try and, like, if you have a conductor who wants sort of a modern interpretation, do you ever try and sort of sneak things by him
Yes.
or her?
Oh, absolutely. I'm like, I cannot bring myself to do, say, oh, I want the Messiah. We'll stick with Messiah. They'll say, I want those first notes quite long. Well, I cannot bear to put a hook bowing in. I cannot bear to do that. So I'm just going to say, okay, sure, yes, we'll just play them longer before we retake. I'm going to do everything I can to avoid
Right. Okay.
modernizing it, but I'm a little bit subversive like that.
I think part of being a smart player is knowing what tricks you can use.
Unless they really got your number, they're not going to push back per se in front of everyone. They're going to say, you're going to play it longer, and then they're going to go on their way most of the time, at least.
So you have done a couple of other things also. You've done the Haitian Orchestral Institute. Do you still do that?
Well, we would, except for that, unfortunately, every year there's been, I went in 2018, and then in 2019, there was a lot of unrest at that time, and we were unable to go. And then, of course, there was pandemic. And then, they've had another earthquake, and we weren't able to go this year. So hopefully, we'll be able to go again next year. It's impossible to know. I mean, things are kind of more unstable there than ever.
Yeah.
But that was a really rewarding experience because there's so much joy in music there that I feel like we got as much from it as they do. We're
Really?
going in there helping them, teaching them orchestral skills, helping them. Our music director Thierry Fisher is part of it, and he goes and conducts the
Oh.
orchestra, and they played Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony last
Really?
time. They did weren't able to do all four movements. I think we did two movements, but this was a stretch for sure for the orchestral skills, and they just don't have the experience, playing in an orchestra, of course. And but they just loved it. They have so much joy, and they were so excited. And every little thing you taught that you would teach them, they would just run off and practice it. And we also did a music drive for the violins, and everybody got a copy of Kreutzer Etudes and of the Bach unaccompanied Bach. So for each instrument, it was different. Usually some kind of etude book, and then some kind of solo music. And because these young people, they had never even owned their own music before. I mean, they had 14th generation mimeograph or something that they're trying to read off of. And so honestly, everything that we did there was so rewarding because of that. And it's not really about Tchaikovsky, of course. It's about learning to discipline and how to work towards something and how to work as a group and the kind of life skills that anyone could use. So it's a wonderful program started by John Eckstein, our cellist, and Yuki McQueen, our violinist from the Utah Symphony. So it was a musician's initiative from the start.
And were you there like for a week about or how long?
Yeah, we were there for a week in
Okay.
March of last time was March of 2018. And we did every day, we would do sectionals and then lessons, and then they would have orchestra rehearsal, and we would be in there to sort of, give tips and help people stay together. And they also played a piece by a Haitian composer as well on the program. And then they had one of the conductors from Haiti conducted that piece. And so it was just, I don't know, it was a really meaningful experience for me, because we got so, I mean, it's hard not to get myopic a little bit in this business. And, you know, things have been, obviously, since the pandemic, you can't afford to just sit in our practice room and not think about what's going on in the world. But that's sometimes easy to do in classical music. So to just get out and really be refreshed with joy from these people is really valuable for us too.
Well, hopefully you're going to get to go back.
I hope so. Yeah, I know we had a wonderful, Hillary Hahn actually did a benefit concert for the Orchestra Institute when she was here in September to raise money to run it. Because the students come from all over Haiti, and obviously they just don't have the means. They don't have to pay. They don't have to pay anything to come to it. You know, it's totally funded. So that was wonderful of her to get involved in that as well.
She seems like I've never met her, but she seems like a really great person.
Yeah, she's extremely caring. I mean, you know, she's our artist in association this season at the Utah Symphony, which means that she comes twice to play, but she also was going out into the schools. She met with young violinists and also did this benefit concert for us. So it's really more of a rich relationship than just showing up and playing a concerto and leaving. And so it's very generous of her to take her time for that.
Yeah, that's great. Well, one thing you do that's really generous is that you rescue animals. and you've rescued evidently more than 100 kittens.
Correct.
Yeah. Could you talk about how you got involved in that and exactly how you go about rescuing a kitten?
well, I've always worked with rescues. So basically you're fostering, you know, the rescues handle the nuts and bolts of procuring said kitten in need of rescuing and also taking care of the, you know, spay neuter, the vet bills and things like that, and also placing them for adoption. So really, although it's a quote unquote altruistic deed, I have to say that playing with kittens for 6 to 8 weeks and watching them learn how to walk and eat and everything, it's not really very difficult of a task. It's pretty fun, pretty darn fun. But I, you know, around 2008, I was struggling a little bit. I had been in my position there at the Baltimore Symphony for a while, and I was really still wanting to be a concertmaster, but I was the second chair at the time, and I was just like, you know, am I going to get there? There's not very many openings I've been auditioned for concertmaster, as you can imagine. There's very few, and one would come along every other season or so, and then if you didn't, you know, didn't go your way, whatever. Then so I was like, I need something else in my life besides music, and you know, I decided that it was a conversation I had with my mother where she said, well, you just need to stop navel gazing. Go help someone else. So I decided to, and I had always had a love for animals. And I was so sensitive as a child that, like, if we had a baby bird that we found or something that we couldn't nurse back to health, I would cry for like 3 weeks. So I was kind of had a soft spot for animals. And so I started volunteering with the rescue group there in Maryland and fostering over the next, I would do maybe 2 or 3 litters of kittens a year.
Meaning that they would stay with you. You'd have them for...
Yeah, and often there's a mother, you know, but mm-hmm. a homeless mother. You know, somebody finds a pregnant cat on the street. And so they come and have their kittens and they're with you for 8 weeks, 8 to 10 weeks. It's fun.
Is that hard to give them away if they've been there for a while?
Well, you know, everybody always asks me that. I know, because if I didn't give them away, I don't get to have more.
So, yeah, oh, okay.
You know, I mean, there's a limit to how many cats you can have. Yeah. I mean, I guess not technically, but you tell people that if you had 9 cats, people would look at you like you're out of your mind. But so I didn't, there was no room for permanent cats in my house at that time. I had my own cats. So if you don't give away the kittens, get them adopted, then you can't get the next batch. So it was in my best interest too. I usually have been sad for about 5 minutes. They're going to good homes, you know, and they're getting much better care than I could give them if I had that many cats. So,
and you still do that?
I did during the pandemic. It's a little bit hard because you have to commit to 6 to 8 weeks without going out of town, which isn't something that I'm usually doing now.
Yeah.
You know, I was in 2008, but I mean, I was playing a Baltimore Symphony almost every week for a whole season, but I'm doing more traveling for playing these days. So I did during the pandemic. I told my husband, I said, when you get back from your trip to McDonald's, there's going to be a few extra residents in the house. And so, yeah. That was fun. kept me going because it was, a dark time for everyone.
Yeah. Well, this has been great. Is there any other thing that you'd like to say or talk about?
I don't think so.
I've learned a lot.
Oh, I have too. It's been a delight.
Yeah, this has really been fun. I hope we have the chance to meet up again sometime.
I hope so too. Next time you make it to Utah, you make sure to look me up.
Oh, for sure. Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.